Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Marianne Fox, the Chancellor of the University of California, San Diego. I want to thank you for coming today to celebrate the extraordinary life and accomplishments of Herbert York. Herb was a personal friend, and he's made a lasting impact on people throughout the world. Everyone who encountered him spoke of him in a way in which gratitude is the predominant emotion. He was many things to many people. He was a scholar, a world-renowned physicist, an advisor, a leader, a teacher, a mentor, a friend, a trailblazer, even a chancellor here at UC San Diego. His life was one which is extraordinary. You can't read about his life, his early life, without naming those who influenced world history so significantly. Oppenheimer, Lawrence, Teller, Berkeley. And working among them to understand nuclear energy and the importance of how to apply technology to military advantage, he always was a person who was open and informal, a kind man, someone who was willing to listen at every stage. In 1952, at the age of 31, an age I must admit is usually not completed a PhD at this school, at age 31, he became the director of Livermore National Laboratory. He also was the first director of the Army Research Progress Administration, DARPA. He was the director, the deputy director of research and engineering at the Army, DDR&E, and he was the chancellor at UCSD in 1961. Yes, Herb was a true pioneer. In fact, he had a knack for being the first person to do anything, and for that we're very fortunate. He also set the standard for excellence and led us to greatness. But it was his early career as a physicist that shaped his life's work and the plan. He helped develop the atomic bomb and realized soon thereafter that the best way to end a war was not to start one. So he became a champion for arms control and social responsibility, and indeed an ambassador for peace. One of his most significant books was called Making Weapons, Talking Peace, illustrative of the complexity of this great man. He had a truly remarkable career as a scientist and as a leader in academia and national security. He received much recognition for his accomplishments over the years, including the Enrico Fermi Award for lifetime achievements, the Vannevar Bush Award for his leadership in the arms control movement and in nuclear energy, and he received the UC Presidential Medal, the Clark Kerr Medal, for his extraordinary contributions to the University of California. He was a true leader in every way, here at UC San Diego and globally. He made this university and our world a better place. And because of his vast contributions, as the first chancellor, as a scholar, a philanthropist, I'm pleased to tell you today that we have renamed our Legacy Society in honor of Herb York. He was a founding member of the Planned Giving Society and understood the importance of supporting the university through philanthropy, particularly in these difficult times. So from here on forward, the Legacy Society will now be known as the UC San Diego York Society in tribute to Herb York. So thank you for being here today to celebrate Herb's life, his accomplishments, his contributions. We mourn the loss of this great man, who was and always will be an integral part of the UC San Diego family. I received many letters from people who were not able to attend this week, and I don't have the time, of course, to read them all. But one from Paul Friedman, Professor Emeritus of Radiology, gave me a quotation which I think strikes the heart. He said, "It's too bad we're all mortal. Herb would have been a good person to always have around," something that I think we can all relate to. So thank you for being here, and thank you to the York family for sharing Herb with us for a few years.
Good morning. I'm Harold Brandt, and I'm here to join with you in celebrating Herb York's life. The man matched the challenge of the times. Herb's personal attributes, intelligence, integrity, judgment, outgoing personality, hard work, combined with the external environment. That environment was the Cold War, nuclear weapons, the importance of technology and of education. The combination made him the leading figure in the creation of a series of institutions. Those institutions, in various ways, continue to serve national security, international peace, military effectiveness and civilian technology, education and research. The Second World War and the Manhattan Project introduced Herb to some of these issues. As he noted, he was at the entry level at that time. The first Soviet nuclear test in September of 1949 and President Truman's consequent decision to proceed with the hydrogen bomb was the first set of events that gave Herb the chance to build an institution. Recognizing his leadership qualities, his mentor, Ernest Lawrence, chose him to create from scratch the Livermore Laboratory, which produced, among other things, the warhead for the Polaris missile, an indispensable part of the U.S. nuclear deterrent. Herb steered the laboratory through a couple of years of growing pains and managed the ambitions and enthusiasms of Edward Teller. As Herb pointed out, the degree of autonomy given to a group whose leaders were in their 20s and 30s would not have been possible even a dozen years later as institutions ossified. The second external event was the Soviet Sputnik in October of 1957 and President Eisenhower's resulting invigoration of the President's Science Advisory Committee under Jim Killian. Herb joined that committee and was drawn more deeply into national and international issues, including arms control, space and missiles, and so forth. In 1958, Herb left Livermore to join the Advanced Research Projects Agency. Actually, the director was a retired General Electric vice president, but Herb was actually, as chief scientist, running the institution. That same 58 Defense Reorganization Act created the post of Director of Defense Research and Engineering, the third-ranking post in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, with line as well as staff responsibility for research and development, approving and disapproving programs, including space programs, missile programs. Herb, a little bit to his surprise, he had anticipated being a bridesmaid, as he told me, rather than a bride, was named as the first director of Defense Research and Engineering early in 1959. He was a major influence on President Eisenhower's decisions, as well as advising Secretaries of Defense McElroy and Tom Gates. Like Eisenhower, Herb was skeptical of what he called Baroque weapon systems. He killed some and held off on others that I had to kill after he left early in 1961 to be the founding chancellor of this institution. Among the less well-known of his achievements while he was in Washington, and one of which he was very proud, was the transfer to NASA of the from the Army and against Army opposition of two of NASA's most important elements, Huntsville and the von Braun team, which created the booster that produced the manned space program, and Caltech's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which came to provide the exploration of the moon and of the solar system. Like Eisenhower, Herb saw both the need for and the dangers of the so-called military-industrial complex. But he was also aware of Eisenhower's concern in that same farewell speech of a phrase, of a passage that gets much less attention about, quote, the danger that public policy could itself become the captor of a scientific technological elite. Others will speak of Herb's efforts outside government on arms control and easing Cold War tensions. Motivated in large part by his Livermore and Washington experience. But I'll note also his service during the Carter administration as leader of the test ban negotiations with the Soviets and membership on a delegation dealing with the military use of space. A final word about Herb York as a person, which comes from my 59-plus years of close professional association and personal friendship. He was interested in almost everything, even arts and music, although those were limited by his red-green colorblindness and what he described as his tone deafness. Whether with family, friends, matters of science, or affairs of state, that interest and enthusiasm led him to think, analyze, discuss, and reach sensible judgments. So he was a rational man. But those same qualities had naturally helped him be an effective creator and leader of institutions. It also, however, made him great fun to be with. As Colleen and I had the great pleasure of experiencing, especially during the past 20 years of lunches and dinners with him and Sybil, talking about anything and everything from the future demography of California to what is the least bad choice for policy in Afghanistan. What a legacy he leaves. What a great inspiration and dear friend to so many of us. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Susan Shirk, and as you may know, Herb was the founder of the University of California Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, based here at UCSD, the organization that I now lead. In 1983, Herb persuaded Governor Jerry Brown and UC President David Saxon to establish IGCC. His idea was that if the University of California system is going to run the nuclear weapons laboratories, Livermore and Los Alamos, then it should also mobilize the knowledge generated by UC scientists and social scientists on all our campuses to prevent nuclear war and other forms of military conflict. Herb believed that the university should not be an ivory tower far removed from the urgent problems of the world today. Even though we at UC are 3,000 miles outside the Beltway, California has a lot to contribute, he believed, to the pressing policy decisions of our time. At IGCC, he brought scholars and policymakers together to work on creative solutions to, especially in the realm of nuclear weapons arm control. From 1983, when he founded IGCC, until this year, when he entered the hospital, he was actively engaged in our research and dialogues and teaching programs. His talks were the highlight of our summer program on public policy and nuclear threats. The students loved to hear his reminiscences about his role in the development of nuclear weapons and negotiations on how to control their spread and use, as well as his very up-to-date, cogent ideas about how to reduce current nuclear proliferation threats. And Herb just loved being with the students. You know, when I read last week that Iran was considering, or said it was considering, sending its nuclear material to Russia and France for further enrichment, I immediately thought to myself how interested Herb would be to see if this really became a step toward a world in which all nuclear operations were under international control instead of under national governments, which is what he felt was really the only and best solution. And today, when I heard the news about President Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize, I could just envision Herb sitting up there with his suspenders, cheering passionately about what the chairman of the Nobel Committee said. He said, "We are awarding President Obama for his extraordinary efforts in order to strengthen dialogue in the world, to resolve conflicts by negotiations and through the international bodies that we have for that purpose." I mean, that's everything that Herb York worked much of his life to achieve, and it's something that the institute he founded continues to work for. Like many of us in the room, I love my frequent conversations with Herb, usually over meals and usually breakfast, the two of us. And he sure did love his hearty breakfasts, such as huevos rancheros. He also loved dim sum. And we would review all the international hotspots, dissect and criticize current U.S. policy, and debate what we would do instead, sympathizing with the dilemmas that the actual officials were facing and congratulating ourselves for how much better our approach would be. Because I am a China scholar, Herb particularly relished discussing China with me. And I'm sure that you all know how much Herb loved China. He taught himself Chinese, and of course he loved Chinese food. He was thrilled that his daughter Rachel had become a China hand, and that he had two beautiful and brilliant Chinese-speaking granddaughters. During the Cold War, at a time when U.S. national security was synonymous with the threat from the Soviet Union, Herb had the foresight to develop partnerships at IGCC with Chinese research institutes and include Chinese and other Asian researchers in our dialogues on security issues. Herb was really one of the first experts on nuclear proliferation to appreciate that the regional neighborhood, the regional context, is a very important influence on a country's decision about whether or not to go nuclear. He invited a Chinese scholar of Sino-US relations, He Di, to attend one of IGCC's first summer programs. And He Di then went on to become a major financier in China and a very important informal advisor to the Chinese government. Herb was so pleased and supportive when I became director of IGCC in 1991. I think having a China scholar as director appealed to his conception of IGCC as a very unconventional institute on international security. When Herb was in the hospital last spring, and we spoke on the telephone because I was on sabbatical, you know what he wanted to talk about? Of course, the North Korean nuclear program. And he was very curious about my recent visit to North Korea. He also wanted to hear all the DC gossip on who was getting what job in the Obama administration, and he was so proud to learn that his former UCSD student, Kurt Campbell, was going to become Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia. Despite all the world's setbacks, temporary setbacks, Herb never lost his sunny optimism about the prospects for world peace and his confidence that today's students would become the next generation of global peacemakers. We miss him deeply, but his inspiration remains with us, and we're determined to sustain his legacy into the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Naomi Oreskes. I'm the provost of Sixth College, and I'm also a professor of history. And it was as a professor that I first got to know Herb York. I first met Herb 11 years ago when I first came to UCSD. I had been teaching at Dartmouth College, where I taught a class on the history of the atomic bomb. And at Dartmouth, every year, a wonderful old physics professor named Leonard Reeser used to come to speak to my students about life at Los Alamos. Professor Reeser had been a young man at the time. He spoke about what it was like to be a young man at Los Alamos, to do physics surrounded by the greats, the geniuses, the giants of modern physics. Leonard was sweet and kind and approachable. And when I came to UCSD, I thought, who could I possibly get to replace Leonard? So I started looking around and checking the website to see who there was here at UCSD, and I was amazed and thrilled to discover that Herb York, whose books on the history of the nuclear weapons development, was not only still alive, but still here and active on campus. So as a historian of science, I had, of course, read Herb's books. I knew who he was. Would he actually come and speak to my undergraduates? So I got a little nervous. It was one thing to have a nice old physics professor come talk to my undergraduates. It was another thing to have Herb York. So I composed an excruciatingly polite email introducing myself, explaining who I was, what the class was, when we met, etc., etc. Herb replied in about 15 seconds, saying that of course he would come, that he would be delighted. In class, he began by talking about his life, starting with his childhood growing up in upstate New York. He described a childhood memory of going to Veterans Day parades where the old Civil War vets would come out to march. My students were completely dumbfounded. They couldn't believe there was anyone alive, much less alive and well and living in California, who had actually met a Civil War veteran. But of course, there was more, much, much more. After the stories about the Civil War vets, Herb would begin to talk about his work, about the Manhattan Project and Ernest Lawrence and all the other remarkable scientists that he would work with. My favorite story was a story about meeting Niels Bohr, who visited Oak Ridge during the Manhattan Project. So this would have been in 43 or 44. And on seeing the massive isotope separation program there, the great Niels Bohr remarked, "Oh, so this is what the brute force method of isotope separation looks like." And Herb said he remembered thinking, brute force. So you mean there's another way to get fissionable material for the atomic bomb? Proving that the secrecy actually, in fact, did work. And Herb told me that it was only until much later that he learned about Hanford and plutonium and all those other things. Herb also told a story about having had a heart attack in the 1950s when Dwight Eisenhower came to visit him in the hospital. He said after that, the nurses treated him really well. And of course, he talked about his work in arms control. And so the students began to understand that now we weren't just talking about history, we were talking to a man who had made history. And Herb welcomed their questions, invited their questions, and answered all of them freely, openly, honestly, and sincerely. As those of you who are my fellow faculty know, sometimes undergraduates ask some pretty weird things, but Herb always treated all of their questions with respect. He treated questions about what the food was like in the USSR or what plane travel was like in the olden days as seriously as questions about how he felt about nuclear Armageddon. And of course, the issues of the consequences of nuclear weaponry were never far from his mind, were always close to his heart. And it was something he was always willing to talk about and talk about sincerely. Now, as a historian, one of the things I have often observed is that many famous people have practiced speeches. They've decided what the official version of their lives should look like, and that's what they'll tell you if you ask about it. But not Herb. Herb always spoke from the heart. He always spoke freely about the way his own views on nuclear weapons had evolved as the historical situation had evolved, and how and why he became committed to arms control after spending the first part of his life creating nuclear weapons. And he told his story in a way that made you know that this wasn't some kind of rational reconstruction of events, it was how they really happened. And more important, he was willing to share how he felt, when these momentous events happened, something that's very hard to convey to students from a book. And in a certain moment, the students would begin to suddenly realize that York Hall was actually named after someone. And that someone was in our class, talking not to them, but with them. And I think the students also started to understand, and maybe even I started to understand in that moment, what it meant to be at UC San Diego. That we don't just talk about the history of science here, we make the history of science here. Herb was great with students in part because it was clear he really cared about them. He may have known presidents, but he never looked down on an undergraduate. He never made them feel as if their questions were trivial or silly. He made them feel that their interest in him and in history mattered. And he did the same for me. Because Herb didn't just come to my class, he insisted on getting to know me, to taking me to lunch. In our case, it was usually lunch at the faculty club, usually at the same table. He always asked about my work. He wanted to know who I was and what I was doing and why I was doing it. He wanted to know what the questions were that drove my work. And when he learned about my projects, he immediately set to work introducing me to people he thought I should know. And in time, also introducing me to Sybil and Rachel. In time, I learned that if I needed to send an email to a famous scientist that I didn't already know, all I needed to do was to ask Herb if he knew them, which of course he invariably did, and ask his permission to write an email that began, "Herb York suggested I contact you." And whoever it was, they always replied, usually the same day. So when I think now about Herb, the thing that stands out for me the most about this great man of science is how interested he was in people. And maybe that was why he was such a great institution builder. For a man of science, he was remarkably interested in the human side of things, in what made people tick, in what their projects were, and in why they were doing the things that they did. He was interested in how individuals made a difference in the world, both for good and bad. And it seems to me that this is what made Herb not just a great scientist, but a great humanitarian. Through my work as a historian of science, I've had the privilege to meet many famous scientists, but only a few great men. Herb York was a great man. And through my work as a historian of science, I have met many famous scientists, but only a few have become my friends. Herb York was my friend, and I really miss him. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Kirk Peterson from the Department of Medicine. I was Herb York's cardiologist. Now, he was a man with a commanding presence and a remarkably creative and decisive mind. And add to this his capacity to articulate highly informed opinions, oftentimes punctuated by restrained but genuine humor, and you will appreciate the Herbert York whose passing we both celebrate and bereave today. By any measure, he was an outstanding leader of our university and somebody to whom we're all indebted. He was also a quintessential American patriot who loved profoundly this country. We're all very, very fortunate to have had his expert, trustworthy, and sober advice on the preeminent issue of our modern history, thermonuclear weapons. For these reasons and many more, it was a signal privilege for me to have been one of a number of physicians and surgeons who throughout his life served his health care needs. I hasten to add, like others have here, that I was very privileged to have been his friend. Now, my first encounter with our first chancellor tells us a great deal about this highly distinguished man. During 1979-1980, I was on sabbatical leave in Switzerland, and during that year, my wife Jeanette and I first met Herb and Sybil York at a fellowship event held at the American Church in Geneva. As we all know, he had a way through his resonant voice and his weighty presence of standing out in any gathering. Perhaps that explains why we gravitated toward him. The then ambassador asked me why, as an American physician, I happened to be in Switzerland. His eyes clearly lit up when I spoke the words training in coronary angioplasty. But then he became visibly animated when he heard the charged four-letter utterance, UCSD. Quickly thereafter, I connected the dots, and I realized that I was in the presence of the very man who had signed my first appointment letter to the UCSD School of Medicine. And in the ensuing conversation, he revealed to me in his direct yet modest fashion that he was heading up the U.S. delegation to the comprehensive test ban negotiations. As I remember, I quipped, perhaps inappropriately, that I would be glad to assist him with any episodes of cardiac pain that he might be experiencing due to Soviet intransigence. By then, a careful diplomat, as well as a skilled physicist, he carefully registered my remarks, even laughed, but then stored them away in his capacious brain, moved on in this public setting to a less threatening topic. We exchanged mailing addresses and parted. I knew that I had been in the presence of a heavyweight, but little did I know how strong the gravitational pull might be of those four letters, UCSD. Not more than 2 to 3 weeks later, we received a formal invitation seeking our attendance at a test ban social gathering to be held in Coppet, a lakeside village near our own temporary domicile. That he was a gracious host at this social event would be an understatement. Ultimately, I took his inordinate attention as a reflection, not of his relief at finding an American cardiologist, at least one nearby, but rather his obvious pride in introducing a member of his own university faculty to both the American and Soviet delegations. People in our society often express their good fortune in finding good physicians. In the case of my relationship with Herbert York, however, the converse was true. I was the lucky one to have found him. Over the ensuing 3 decades, we had many medical as well as social encounters, and none were perfunctory or routine. Herb never would let them be so. In fact, every lunch that we shared at the faculty club was a stimulating experience of Socratic dialogue, with Herb illuminating and defining contemporary political and social issues with clarity and vision. But not all of our out-of-clinic conversations revolved around matters of university, state, and country. One of my most memorable encounters was a telephone call in the year 2000 that I received at 3 a.m. Dr. York inquiring with his robust voice as to whether he should go through with a proposed coronary stent implantation by a cardiologist in Hong Kong. Like a man skilled at perfecting informed consent, he understood all the issues that confronted him. After hearing his story told with exacting precision, I mustered my best post-midnight mental acuity and advised him to proceed. Fortunately for him and for me, the procedure went well, and he soon was on his way back to the USA. I always felt unusually complimented by his trust in my physicianship, and the memories of these privileged interactions will always linger. Now, in the last decade of his life, I witnessed Herbert York under very trying, life-threatening circumstances, a period during which he faced his health problems with sustained determination and grit. In fact, like few patients that I have ever witnessed in my medical career. In 2001, even while undergoing extensive chemotherapy for a malignant blood disorder, he never gave up hope and ultimately experienced a very prolonged remission. His effective and decisive management style undoubtedly contributed to this success. For example, if I asked him in the morning, "How was your night, Herb?" he would succinctly reply, "You tell me." Or if I went to review once again the risks of proceeding with a proposed surgery, he answered, "Kirk, I don't think we'll visit that decision again." And just before heading into the operating room, He was heard to tell the anesthesiologist, "Let's get this show on the road." And when I'm a hospitalized patient, I plan on emulating his style. At the same time, for a man who had been in the highest arenas of power and influence, he faced this difficult twilight of his life with admirable enthusiasm and equanimity. I also sensed a well-earned confidence that he had fully vindicated his creation, that both he and his dear and loyal wife, Sybil, had fully acquitted themselves to their family and their fellow citizens. Several weeks before his departure from us, Herb made a point of telling me that he was not fearful of death. Refusing to consider such an outcome for our esteemed patient, I did not ask him to elaborate. However, I happen to like a poem, author unknown, that I believe captures Herbert York's attitudes as he felt the waning of his physical strength. And there may be a lesson there for all of us. It reads, "Fear not that which is now, fear not that which is to come. Life, death, and being are as one. It is a circle. There is no beginning and no end. Surely the lessons of life are the wisdom of death. Those that live in the knowledge of what the circle truly is have peace beyond measure." I believe that Herbert York is at peace and that his life, spirit, and stewardship will encircle forever the community of UCSD. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ching. I'm Herb York's granddaughter. I've always known my grandfather was a special man. I've been told since I can remember how smart and respected he was. It wasn't until many years later, though, that I realized that not every kid has a grandfather who had achieved such a great deal and had such an influence on history and the people around him. To me, it was almost as if he was two different people. One was Herb York, renowned physicist, venerated first chancellor of UCSD, advisor to more presidents than I could name, and so much more. Sometimes I saw that man when other people were around, when they came to greet him and shake his hand in restaurants, when I turned on PBS and by chance stopped channel surfing to watch a documentary on World War II and he appeared on the screen, sitting on the balcony at Camino de la Costa being interviewed. The other man, the one I knew, was my gunggung, which means grandfather on your mother's side in Cantonese. We four grandchildren called him that because of his knowledge of Chinese and because my sister and I grew up in Hong Kong. He could be impatient at times, even a little intimidating, but so deeply sweet and loving. The best to hug because he was a big, soft bear of a man with that round, permanently stubbled face. Sitting at the head of the table when my family gathered for Sunday brunch, squinting his eyes and laughing his idiosyncratic laugh. A lot of the time, the topics of conversation were beyond me. They ranged over so much that only a lifetime spent in the pursuit of knowledge and a faithful dedication to what Gunggung referred to as News Freak Night or the Friday night news programs would allow me to truly keep up to. Though I'm not just speaking for myself today, I'm speaking for all the grandkids. For my cousin Eddie, who would dare to challenge Gunggung to games of Go, who reminded me that I must remember Gunggung as the great storyteller and thinker. For my cousin Marian, who in the tradition of Gunggung is in the jungle in Costa Rica, learning and experiencing what the world has to offer. And for my sister Sophie, who made him so proud when she went to study at an Ivy League, even if it meant breaking the trend of York grandkids attending UCs. This summer, my dad climbed Mount Kilimanjaro and dedicated the climb to Gungun and left a photograph of him on the peak. He brought Gungun with him because Gungun was an adventurer and would have loved to have traveled so far, have made that climb, and have had the world at his feet. Every mountain we climb, every new place we go, and every chance we take, he's a part of it. In all that we do, he's honored and loved. We are so proud to be his grandchildren. He is always with us, and we miss him so much.
Greetings to you all. On behalf of my mother, Sybil, my sister, Cynthia, our brother, Dave, our spouses, and our four grandchildren, I'm so proud of all of them. I'd like to thank all of you for coming to celebrate Dad, especially our many friends who've come from very far away, from Hong Kong, from Ireland, and all over the United States. Thanks to Chancellor Fox, the speakers, the wonderful musicians, and everyone here at UCSD who made today possible. Someone was asking me about the music when you were sitting down. That was one of the favorite groups of Mom and Dad. Some of you might remember the Gateway Singers, who used to perform at the Hungry Eye in the 50s. One of Dad's favorite songs from them was called "Bury Me in My Overalls," and he loved it. He used the tapestoes to it, so we decided it would be appropriate for today. Growing up with Dad and Mom has to have been one of the most exciting, blessed childhoods a person can imagine. When I look back, I think of an almost seamless series of walks and meals with Dad, never in congenial silence, always talking about politics, walking through La Jolla, nature, hiking through Yosemite. Tamerlane was one of his favorites when we were pushing through the markets of Uzbekistan. And writing Chinese characters together on dirty warehouse windows or fine linen tablecloths from Amsterdam to Toledo, from Transylvania to the Rhondda Valley. A typical Dad moment that I cherish was when he was recovering from leukemia in 2001. And there he was sitting in his chair in the living room, amusing himself by reading Chairman Mao's speeches on agrarian reform in the original Chinese, laughing his special herb laugh when he'd worked out that the phrase zhi lao hu actually meant paper tiger. He thought that was so funny. I remember once I was in Ulaanbaatar. I was leading a tour in 1981 when only about 500 people a year came through Mongolia. We were staying in Hotel B. Hotel A was closed for repairs. Hotel B also housed the French, Portuguese, British, and Canadian embassies. One morning at breakfast, I was walking through the dining room, and there was a table with about 8 very bored-looking men and a little Canadian flag in the middle of the table. And one of them leapt up and said, "Excuse me, miss, would you join us for a cup of coffee?" I sat down and discovered they were the Canadian embassy, and the fellow opposite me was Lester Pearson Jr., whose father was the Prime Minister of Canada and the Peace Nobel Prize winner. And he was himself the ambassador to Russia and Mongolia, so he happened to be in town. And in my shy, retiring way, I said, "Oh, well, my dad's an ambassador, too." And he said, "Well, who's that? Which country?" And I said, "Well, he's ambassador to the CTBT talks, and his name's Herb York." And Pearson frowned. He scowled. His dewlap shook. And he said to the people in general at the table, he said, "You know, sometimes Herb York is the only sane voice in America." Well, I glowed, and I'm still glowing. And when I told Dad that story about a year later, he said, "Say, do you think he'd like a copy of my book?" And then years later, Pearson was at Mom and Dad's house, and he said, "Say, did you ever hear the story about meeting your daughter in Outer Mongolia?" And Mom, so many people have commented to Cynthia and me what a special relationship they had. They celebrated their 60th anniversary last September, and I'd like to share a bit of family lore. Dad and Mom met while they were students at Berkeley during the war. Dad was babysitting the cyclotron, and Mom was working as a student telephone operator in a top-secret war location. He heard her voice on the telephone, decided to find her. He deduced that this top secret war location was actually in the basement of Sproul Hall. He showed up and asked if he could see her home. Out of the blue, she thanked him prettily and said she had other plans. And so she did. Her plans were to walk home by herself to her parents' home on Bancroft Avenue. Blooming friendship was cut short by the war. Dad was sent off to his secret location to work on the Manhattan Project in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. 2 years later, after the war, Mom ran into Dad standing on the steps of the Campanile at Berkeley, eating raisins. He offered her some. He said he hadn't seen the Farallon Islands in a long time, and he'd heard they were good for your eyesight. And what a good line. So they started to see each other again. They had their first date at the Oppenheimers. Dad asked Mom if she had a long dress to wear for their St. Patrick's Day party. She said, of course she did. Ran home to ask her mother to make her one. So they never looked back. The girl from Button Willow, California, and the fella from Rochester, New York, they went from discussing arms control with the Archbishop of Canterbury over tea at Lambeth Palace to discussing Planet of the Apes over cocktails with Nicholas Ceausescu in his Romanian palace. Dad gloried in life. You all know that. He never lost his excitement and interest in meeting new people, going to new places, and of course, eating new things. His dad and his granddad were train guards on the Buffalo-New York line. Dad spent his youth with my grandfather traveling the line to New York City. His second grade teacher wrote in his report that his ability in arithmetic was uncanny. But he was almost expelled from high school for being a delinquent and for his very low grades. Happily, one teacher recognized that he was indeed a very special boy. And she managed to get him into the University of Rochester. He often said that he had no idea that a person could love his job. To him, a job was a way of getting food on the table. There was no joy in it. It was the Depression. When he did go to university, he was stunned and he was thrilled to meet professors who loved what they were learning, doing, and teaching. And he never lost that thrill. In his final days, he held our hands. He looked directly into our eyes. And he said firmly, "I want you to know I'm satisfied. I'm satisfied with you, and I'm satisfied with my life. Thank you."
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.